In her new book, Rebel Health, Susanna Fox focuses on the healthcare needs of patients and caregivers. She points out the need for better communication and networking for anyone who has difficulty navigating the American healthcare system.
With all of the technology that we have now, at the base of it, it's really about the connection between and among people who are facing the same challenge, who are lost in the maze of healthcare, who find out that they're not alone. And that moment that you find that just in time someone like you, it's the same incredible excitement that we all felt in the early days of being online. It's the same feeling that people have now on TikTok and whatever is the latest platform.
Hey everybody, welcome to the latest episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast. I'm John Lebkoski, and I am joined by my co-hosts, Scoop Sweeney and Wendy Grossman. And our guest today is the wonderful Susanna Fox, who I'm very psyched to see here joining us. A lot of what we're going to talk about today is a book that she's written called Rebel Health. Susanna is she's really a health and technology strategist. And the book that she's written is about what we have also called participatory medicine, which is a hard thing to say. It doesn't kind of roll off the tongue, so I think Rebel Health is better. And she used to be chief technology officer for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which I can imagine was a pretty challenging job. And she's also worked with Pew Foundation, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, a number of things. And she knows the territory, you know, that we're talking about today, because we both got introduced to this kind of thinking by the same guy, Dr. Tom Ferguson, many, many years ago. And I guess my first question for you is, you were one of several people that were connected with Tom. Tom was a physician who advocated for self-care and patient empowerment. So how did you make your connection with him? How did you kind of get into this thinking about patient empowerment and self-care?
Well, first I want to say thank you for having me. And as in so much of life, it's all about luck. So when I was just starting out as a researcher looking at the social impact of the internet on American society, I wrote my very first report about the internet's impact on healthcare. This was in the year 2000. And just to remind listeners, that's when only about 50% of US adults had access to the internet. Broadband was in only about 5% of homes. We didn't have, you know, mobile phones with all the apps and all that good stuff. But people were connecting online, and I hit send to my boss and editor, Lee Rainey. I finished writing that report on November 1st, the year 2000. And I remember it well because I gave birth to my first child the next day and therefore was on maternity leave for most of the press for that report. And Lee was on a radio show, a national public radio show with Tom Ferguson. And they hit it off so well. I think the host maybe wanted there to be a point counterpoint, but they hit it off so well that Lee actually called Tom down in Austin, Texas and said, "Would you please be an advisor to us? You clearly need to be involved in the research that we're doing." And when I came back from maternity leave, I had a mentor and someone who turned out to be, of course, a dear friend.
Yeah, he was really great. He and Lee Rainey are both great guys. I can just imagine them working together. So how do you see the evolution of patient participation in healthcare treatment since Tom initially came up with the idea of the e-patient, which was really empowered patient?
Well, what's great is that working with Tom was like getting a being part of a one-person PhD seminar where he was able to give me academic readings, as well as take me like we were anthropologists going into online communities of people living with rare and life-changing diagnoses. What Tom foresaw, even in the 1980s, and which is only really now coming fully to fruition so many years later, is that at the base of everything, the internet connects us not only to information, but also to each other. And it's that connection to each other and what I eventually came to call peer-to-peer healthcare that was at the basis of a lot of Tom's work in the 1980s and the 1990s, really beginning on listservs and bulletin board systems and the well, and now continuing with all of the technology that we have now. At the base of it, it's really about the connection between and among people who are facing the same challenge, who are lost in the maze of healthcare, who find out that they're not alone. And that moment that you find that just in time someone like you, it's the same incredible excitement that we all felt in the early days of being online. It's the same feeling that people have now on TikTok and whatever is the latest platform.
One of the great things about this book is that, actually, I mean, this is sort of the meat of the book, is that you have done clearly a careful analysis over the years of this space, and you've created a framework for understanding it. And your framework involves a grid and some personas, basically. Could you just talk about that a little bit and kind of describe the framework that you've created?
Sure. So I'll sort of draw it. It's a very simple 2x2. The X axis, the horizontal line, at one side, we should place all the people whose needs are not being met by mainstream healthcare. And what's very important is that they themselves get to decide whether their needs are being met. It's not actually up to the rest of us. If someone has a question that they are not getting answers to, then their needs are not being met. At the other side are everyone whose needs are being met. And great, that's good for them. That's where we all want to be. The Y-axis, at the top, we can place things that are visible to the mainstream healthcare system. Everybody knows about them. There's a clear diagnosis. Scientists and clinicians are all working busily. There's options for people because it's a visible problem to mainstream healthcare. At the bottom are all those challenges that are invisible. What's really important here is that people who are invisible and their needs are not being met, they're the ones who feel most alone. They may be dealing with something that's mysterious. They may have a constellation of symptoms. They don't know what it is yet. Or they may have a diagnosis that is rare. Or they may be experiencing discrimination. They may be locked out of care because of geography. There's all sorts of reasons why someone is not having their needs met and they feel invisible. But the good news is that the patient-led revolution has emerged from all of the radical health movements of the last 100 years. And the archetypes that I describe in the book are the people that you'll meet in the revolution who can help people get out of that quadrant of despair, of feeling invisible and your needs not being met.
Well, I've been a caregiver for my wife, who is seriously disabled, for about 15 years. And she has encountered difficulty getting care at very big, responsible hospitals here because they're not set up she can't get onto their treatment tables. If she goes into emergency, they have to bring in four or five, because, you know, she weighs a bit, and they have to lift her up onto these things. And there is no reason that they shouldn't be able to do that other than cost. And a lot of those problems come from upper management, who says, if it costs too much, we're not going to do it because we don't get a big profit. How do people deal with that? I mean, I thought we had the Americans with Disability Act, but that doesn't seem to be followed quite closely in medical care.
What you are describing is something that is unfortunately typical, and that is that healthcare and hospitals and doctor's offices are often geared towards the average, and that, by the way, often means men. So much of drug testing and so much of what we know that's published in the medical literature is based on studies of men. It's also based on expectations about the size of someone's body that don't take into account the full range of human experience. And you're absolutely right that it is often cost that people make decisions that turn out not to make sense. And it's clear that what you're describing, your wife's needs are not being met. And I'm sorry about that.
You know, it strikes me that in healthcare, really one way to describe it is that physicians and healthcare providers kind of have a template for treatment that's based on some sense of what an average human being is. And we're all unique. And this, to me, is one of the things that makes the patient-led movement so important, because nobody knows their unique body better than the person who is the body, you know? And in the book that you've created, you talk about how to empower these particular people, and you refer to them as archetypes. They're really sort of like ideally could work together, starting with a seeker, which would just be somebody who has a healthcare problem and there's no clear solution for it. It may have something to do with something that's fairly unique about them. They may not know anybody else who's got that problem, but then when they are on the internet, when they maybe go into a community of people who have similar situations, they meet people who are a lot more like them. And I think one of the things that you've described, well, I shouldn't be putting words in your mouth here. Why don't you describe what happens when, Well, when the seeker shows up in the community, what can happen?
Yeah, so seekers are people who decide to go and find out. There's a spark that changes them from a passive consumer who's being carried along on the conveyor belt of healthcare. And something happens. They might fall off the conveyor belt, and from their position on the floor, they decide to stand up and ask questions. Or they feel like they're just not getting the care and answers that they need. And what typifies a seeker is that they will not give up. And my argument for the healthcare system is that that's a good thing. We actually need seekers. We need seekers to engage and ask more difficult questions. The three other archetypes I'll go through quickly. The second type that I talk about in the book are networkers. And frankly, those are the people that make the most noise on social media. And so a lot of people, when I start talking about peer-to-peer healthcare and e-patients, people say, oh, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about Facebook. And I say, yes, and. It's Facebook, but it's so much more than that. It's the actions that people take where people learn in community. Networkers are also the people who, when they find something that works, they can't wait to share it with the rest of the group, everyone else who has that condition. So networkers are natural publicists for healthcare. The third group are solvers. Solvers are people who, if they're faced with a device that doesn't work for them, they're likely to take it apart and put it back together again. They're inventors. People with disability are often solvers because they're the ones who are saying, this assistive device doesn't work. I'm going to invent something that does work. And then the fourth group are champions. Champions are people who have access to mainstream resources, who can let a patient-led group take their innovation to scale. And mainstream resources could, of course, be things like funding or regulatory guidance or access to manufacturing facilities.
How much are you finding that this sort of self-help and group shared help is being impeded by things like, I read Cory Doctorow a lot, and he's talked about basically digital rights management embedded in wheelchairs so that somebody not only cannot repair their own wheelchair, but is prone to getting stuck somewhere where there's no, the official repairman can't get to. How much are you finding that that's an interference in what you're talking about?
It's a significant interference, and it's a problem that we should all be concerned about. My friend Jose Gomez Marquez at MIT runs something called the Little Devices Lab, where he draws attention to the need for all of us to understand how things work and how we should all be able to repair our own devices. The other Jose often brings up tractors as another area that you used to be able to fix your own tractor, and now you can't.
Cory talks about John Deere a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah,
but I mean, I think there's a special place in hell for people who would trap someone in a non-functioning wheelchair because it's good for business.
Totally agree. And the other area, which is very interesting, is diabetes devices. So when it was discovered that patients and caregivers were able to hack into a continuous glucose monitor and free the data, device manufacturers quickly set about improving those devices to lock them out, right? And so there is a burgeoning market on eBay and Facebook Marketplace for older continuous glucose monitors, because patients who have tasted the freedom of being able to modify their own CGM and send the data to their Apple Watch or wherever they want it to go, they don't want to get back in the box. They want this access. And it was patients and caregivers who forced the industry to acknowledge that they were capable of this kind of innovation and led the FDA to basically say to companies, we're looking at this and we think that this is a good thing. This is actually improving the safety and effectiveness of the devices. So don't use the government as your shield to say that devices should be locked down. So great innovation has happened because patient and caregiver hackers were able to essentially break in and take what they need. I'd love to see more of that happening.
Yeah, and you know,
it's a good time to mention. It's a good time to mention Hugo Campos. Dave DeBrancard and Hugo Campos were on our podcast once before, and Dave's thing is, give me my damn data. Access to data is something that should not be constrained for patients, and Hugo, famously by now, I think the story is out, was hacking into pacemakers in order to figure out how his pacemaker worked so that he could hack it himself.
You mention
him in the book.
The other thing is, when they talk about concerns for safety, well, I understand that. You don't want somebody, you know, sort of screwing things up too much. But at the same time, if what you're concerned about is safety, then as a company, why not provide a set of software tools that allow you to verify the integrity of the device? You know, and I think that would be particularly important if there is a secondary market for these things.
Absolutely right. And what a lot of diabetes activists would say is, you know, it's really unsafe, us not being able to get access to our data, us not being able to have the information that we need to manage our own health. That's what's really unsafe.
It's particularly interesting to me because I live in the UK, and one of the things you kind of have to get your head around as an American in Britain is that your access to the healthcare system is basically entirely through your GP. Your GP is kind of the gatekeeper. I mean, it's changed a bit now, but when I first moved here, you couldn't look up a specialist in the phone book. You would go to your GP. Even now, my optician says you should have cataract surgery, and they give me a referral letter, which I take to the GP, and the GP sets the whole thing and the whole train in motion. And if you have the wrong sort of GP, they can act as an incredible block on your access to things. As it happens, I seem to have a very good one, and I actually wanted her in that particular loop because I know she's married to an ophthalmologist.
Yeah, but you're pointing out something that I've thought about is the patient-led revolution something that is uniquely American, or is it something that we can see happening in other countries? One of the examples that I talk about in the book that's in the UK is in the UK, there's such thing as link workers, and that's people who work in the community and know what's happening, know what the resources are for health and wellness in the community, and they make sure that GPs have, as they put it, a stocked cabinet of community resources, so that, for example, if someone's dealing with, they're newly diagnosed with something that could benefit from learning from peers, then in the UK, it's a GP that's actually going to recommend that to you. I would love to see that brought over to the United States and spread nationwide, worldwide, that this idea is that it's not just rogue patients who are finding each other online, that this is actually something that a doctor could recommend, like John, our friend Danny Sands, who was a doctor who recommended that ePatient Dave join ACOR, Association of Cancer Online Resources, which made all the difference in the world. Why can't it be so that even in, I'm just going to say it, paternalistic healthcare systems, why can't it be so that they recommend peer-to-peer healthcare resources?
Yeah, and the thing that strikes me is that when you have a condition, the condition isn't really consistent. You have different it kind of what ebbs and flows. It can change. So, for instance, if you're a diabetic, and this just occurred to me reading your book, really, if you're a diabetic, your blood sugar levels fluctuate, right? And it would be very powerful for you to know what those blood sugar levels were 24 hours a day versus, just spot checking, And I think about, like I have AFib and I'm in a pretty good position because I can constantly monitor my heart because I have a watch, an Apple device that will somewhat do that anyway. It's somewhat reliable. And this is something that, I mean, a physician is not going to spend 24 hours a day with you checking on things, but we have ways to gather data persistently and to create triggers and alerts that will warn us if there's a problem. And this is something that is just starting to dawn on people, I think. I mean, isn't this kind of like, for physicians, isn't this kind of like new thinking?
Well, I think that so I should confess immediately that I'm an optimist, and I really believe that the more access we have to information and data, the better. And I do believe that patients and survivors and caregivers should have the power to change their fate. They should be able to, for example, do N of one personal science experiments to find out, as Hugo did, for example, that whiskey sent him into AFib, but rum did not. There's no clinical trial for that. But there was, there's important information that has to do with the basic tenets of life of how do I make sure that I have a good night's sleep tonight? I think that actually anybody with a newborn baby is engaged in personal science. They're constantly saying, what was it today that made the baby sleep through the night? And you think about how does that apply to all of us? All of us should have access to these personal science tools. Another word for it is quantified self, so that we can figure stuff out for ourselves. Because, and I'll name another person, Sarah Rigger, who lives in Sweden. She had early onset Parkinson's disease. And what she talks about is she lives the great majority of her life. I think it's 8,765 hours of the year. She's managing her own Parkinson's disease, and she has 1 hour with her neurologist. So all of that management that she does, she should have access to the data that she needs to make the tweaks and make the decisions to optimize her health. Or, by the way, not. Like, if you want to go without all this data, that's also fine. I want to be clear.
Yeah, I was going
Yeah,
to
you
say
know, I.
there. I noticed, I remember visiting very, very early on the first self-quantified group, and sitting there thinking, I don't want to sit around taking my temperature every. I didn't even know. I didn't even own a thermometer until the COVID pandemic, when it became obvious that it was a social grace to take your temperature before you went out and interacted with people. Never had one, and I
Like
must have known these
carrying
people.
a handkerchief, carrying a handkerchief and your thermometer.
But so many of the, but at the same time, so many of the people that I saw at these meetings, I didn't go to very many, but they all had intractable things that made their lives really difficult and miserable, and they were things that the medical establishment really hadn't been able to grapple with for one reason or another. And the self-tracking helped them. I think even if it didn't actually give them useful data that helped them manage the condition better, I think it gave them a more of a sense of empowerment, that they were actively trying to do something about it, and that they were learning things about themselves.
Thank you so much for bringing that up, because the quantified self movement is an example of a radical health movement that has shown us the way. They were very early on this idea of, again, thinking about my rebel health matrix of their issues, their needs were not being met, and they felt invisible. Their mysteries were not being investigated. And so they decided to investigate those issues themselves. They are using every tool at their disposal. And what I love about these ideas that seem really on the fringe, and something that our friends who are always like pushing the limits, the cowboys and the hackers and the artists of healthcare, they're actually moving closer and closer to the mainstream. As John points out, now you have an Apple Watch that is tracking a lot of this stuff. That 20 years ago, people didn't have those tools, but were still interested in tracking their heart rate. Anyway, I just it's a wonderful example of how we look to the pioneers to see where the possible future will be built. I think that mainstream healthcare has a lot to learn from the radical patients.
Well, I think that was one of the great things about Anthony Fauci, was that in, sort of confronted with these angry AIDS patients, he recognized that they were right, and embraced the idea that patients should have some input into how how the drugs were approved and how the medical establishment treated them. I thought that was,
Intellectually honest, yes.
Yeah, and have the information to have somewhat informed input, to have the data at their disposal. And I am finding that I can get more and more data. I've noticed that my chart is carrying a lot more data about that has been gathered about me by my primary care physician et al. And I just recently discovered that I could read the notes on, I had a couple of surgeries within the last year or so, and there's a detailed set of notes for each one of those surgeries that the surgeon, prepared. And I can look into that and have a very good sense of what happened, which gives me a much better understanding of the condition that they were addressing and aftercare and all of those kinds of things. But I also realize there's a lot of people who would hate to see any of that stuff. They wouldn't want to have anything to do with it. They really don't want to see this data about themselves. They don't want to read about how their surgery went. And then there's people who could, I mean, they might read that stuff and radically misinterpret it and start coming up with crazy ideas and become fearful and maybe assail the doctors or whatever. So I've wondered about how we sort of address those variations in the way that this works. I mean, I'm very happy to see that things are set up to be better for people like me, and that when I talk to my doctors, they'll discuss with me collaboratively versus, just say, well, I know what you need. That's it. And pretty much all the physicians I've been with over the years have been that way. So I think it's maybe more common than we think. But I know that they have painful situations with some people who come in and really don't understand what's going on. They're fearful and really can't they can't they can't they can't work with the information as well, I guess. So have you thought about that, about those variations?
I have. I'll take the first one, the people who don't want to look at the surgery notes. And I honor that. My dad was that way. He had multiple issues. And it was my mom, his caregiver, who was the one who joined the communities, who read his entire medical chart, who knew all about the drugs that he was taking. And that is a model that a lot of us can follow. I myself have played the role of proxy seeker for various loved ones and friends who actually just this week heard from a loved one who got some scary test results. The test results got returned to her in my chart. They're very worrying. She went down the rabbit hole of reading every medical journal article, and then she called me and said, "Could you help me? I'm getting overwhelmed by all of this. And actually, what I just need to know are, what are the questions that I should bring when I meet with my doctor?" And so I took on that, and I was the seeker. Instead of her, frankly, freaking out and losing sleep, I said, "Give that to me. That's a task that I can do for you." And I actually posted it on my blog this morning, the questions that she can ask. To the other side, are actually the dangers of access to information. There's some wonderful research that was done by Open Notes, which the reason, John, that you probably have access to your surgical notes is because of this organization, Open Notes. And they did some really wonderful studies that showed, are there bad outcomes from people having full access to their medical record? And they studied it at higher income medical centers, as well as the medical centers that are more safety net Medicaid population, equal. The benefits were clear, the drawbacks are few. And even the there were very skeptical doctors who said, these are my notes. There should be no reason why a patient should be reading my notes about their body. After the pilot, they found, I think it was 97% of physicians said, actually, I agree that patients should have access to this material. You then have a group of patients who are prepared for the meeting, you know, where everybody has access to the same information, and you don't have to spend the very short 15 minutes with the patient explaining what the test results are. They've Googled it. They've read maybe some medical journal articles about it. The challenge is when someone goes down a rabbit hole and gets caught in a whirlpool of misinformation. And that's
I was thinking of autism in that respect. I mean, autism isn't a disease or anything, but you know, one of my friends, when his son was diagnosed 20 years ago, encountered a lot of parents who were so desperate that they were sort of clutching at any straw they could find. And you know, that leaves them open to exploitation by all sorts of people, as we've seen, because that's where the whole anti-vaccination movement in its modern incarnation came from. But this is an important topic for me, because the whole thing about notes, because when I was 40, I realized I had no medical history at all. When I was in my 20s, I asked my pediatrician for my notes. And at that time, I don't think he had to give them to me. And he said, oh, there isn't anything in there that would be useful to you. Well, I don't believe that. I think that was much more likely that he'd written some things that were unflattering, and he was afraid that I would, you know, either about me or about my mother, and didn't want me to see them. But I mean, how is it possible that a pediatrician you've had from the age of 10 to the age of 20 would not have anything in the notes that was useful? You know, I have no record of whether I have dim memories of getting polio vaccine, but I don't have any empirical evidence of it. I keep my own notes, but it is surprisingly, because I think of the British medical establishment is much more, even more paternalistic and slower to change. Actually, they're very free with notes. I asked the GP for, you know, something or other, and they said, oh, sure. And they cheerfully printed out every interaction they'd ever had with me. It was amazing. But they give you, I ask for copies of the test results, they give them to me. I'm sort of constantly surprised.
It just shows that we're in a constant state of evolution, you know, what I think is that I personally believe that the more people have access to information and data, the better. Mm-hmm. And I want to always hold space for people who don't want to look.
Well, the other question, well, there's two other questions that occur to me. One is to wonder whether you or any other organization is doing work on data formats so that the data you get from different tests and different devices and stuff can actually be held to some common standard that would help you have a tool that could interpret it and bring it together. But the other is how we get equality of access. I mean, John is in a very privileged small group of people who own Apple Watches. I don't want to buy into Apple's ecosystem just in order to find out what my heart rate is. And there are lots of people who can't afford Apple Watches and barely can afford medical care, which is not so much of a problem in this country, fortunately. So how do you get equity for the people who are locked out simply economically?
You bring up two really important issues. The first one is about interoperability of data and the data formats. And that's actually something that I worked on in the Obama administration at HHS. So part of the role of the chief technology officer was to run an innovation lab where we actually brought in outside innovators to attack a specific problem, a high priority problem within a federal health agency. And we also taught federal workers how to think like an entrepreneur. The other half of the job was actually running an open data lab. Data, of course, is collected at scale by the government. And there's always been laws on the books about open data, meaning the publication of data, but there were no laws and standards around how that was going to be released. And so, if you can believe it, for many years, federal health agencies got away with publishing data as PDFs, which is, of course, not really publishing the data. And under the Obama administration, that was changed so that we would now federal health agencies, if there's public data that should be released to the public, the data is published in a machine-readable format. Another aspect of this data, which gets to the personal health record, electronic health record interoperability, is again something that the federal government oversees and very much has a had a hand in creating the ecosystem of electronic health records and requiring that there is an interoperability. What I'm personally very excited about is the FHIR standard, which really is truly making things, it making a layer of interoperability over top of all of the legacy healthcare data systems. Yes, and what I think that is also very interesting is to think about, to bridge to your other question about equity. One of the kind of clear and present dangers now is that there is like a few big players in terms of health data, Apple being one of them. Google would very much like to, I feel like they're constantly trying to re-enter the conversation about health data. And then we think about, for example, Epic, makers of one of the most dominant electronic health record systems. These are all, there's so much collection of data that individuals may or may not have access to. The other thing, so to the equity question of not everybody can afford an Apple Watch, that is absolutely true. And I'll bring back again the thread about quantified self, because it's like that I'm going to quote a James Bond movie. Sometimes the old ways are the best ways, where we find that there's actually a low-cost alternative to the Apple Watch. And there might be tools that are available, but again, our understanding and knowledge of that is unevenly distributed, which is what networkers could help with. So that if there is something that is an inexpensive alternative to, for example, tracking your heart rate, in the patient-led revolution, the networkers are the ones who would find that and publicize that to the group.
Well, in a previous life, I was an IT manager for Kaiser Permanente in California, and I experienced interesting warfare between the business and IT. This was at the beginning of attempts to create an electronic medical record. And that just frightened the heck out of the doctors. It frightened the business people. They really didn't want these patients knowing what they were doing. I had to defend myself against doctors when I would go out and visit in a facility to a hospital or a clinic, and doctors would say, "We can't get these things to patients. I'll have to rewrite all of their medical records because of the things I put in it." I said, "Well, maybe you shouldn't be putting those things in there if it's not legitimate or correct. there's a big problem, and got into all sorts of difficulties because of that. The whole idea of the internet becoming involved in medical care just caused people to panic. They didn't want this stuff going out to someone else. And I don't know how much that's changed in the interim, but then, you know, for a long period of time, it was warfare between the data people and the medical people.
And unfortunately, well, for better or for worse, I think that the war is over and the doctors lost. This is now not about my book and really just coming at it from my experience in health IT and looking across the landscape and seeing the pain and struggle that a lot of doctors are experiencing because they are being asked to spend as much time typing in notes as they spend with a patient. Patients are fed up with it because doctors are looking at the computer and not looking at them. These systems were very much set up for billing purposes. They were not necessarily set up for care purposes. And so the business people and the IT people, I think, won the battle in terms of setting up these electronic health records, which were not as much about what doctors and patients care about, but very much what the billing system cares about.
I have to ask the obligatory question, how is AI going to affect all this?
It's a great question. There are, of course, multiple ways that AI is going to affect the patient-led revolution. I will say that anyone who is designing an AI tool that touches on patient care should involve patients in the design of the tool. It's going to be a competitive advantage. If you are in a competitive marketplace, having people on the team who have the lived experience that you are trying to solve for, you should involve patients. Something I'm very intrigued by. I'll give two examples that I think are hopeful. One is a company called Synapticure, which is focused on neurological diseases and disorders like ALS and Parkinson's. Often patients present at a new doctor with, if it was printed out, it would be a very, very thick stack of imaging and clinical notes. They might even have brought their own self-tracking. There's just an enormous amount of data. And what Synapticure is now doing is using AI to feed all of that imaging and all of those clinical notes and all of that evidence into the LLM so that a new clinician could actually get a one-pager that summarizes the notes about that patient. So instead of having to spend hours and hours and hours reading through all of these reports, AI can simplify that. And so getting a second opinion or even just understanding your own case, I think is going to be much better. And those are that's an example that from Synapticure, but I think that is a possibility for all chronic conditions. The other thing is that I'm very hopeful about is looking at all of the conversations that have occurred online that are archived hold so much insight about the human experience with illness, the human experience with certain treatments that is not in the published medical literature. So right now, a lot of these large language models are being trained only on the published medical literature. And therefore, it's leaving out the lived experience of patients and survivors and caregivers. I'll tell one story as an example. I know someone who was being asked to make a decision about a drug, and there's two very good drugs for this certain condition, and the doctor said, "I can't make this choice for you. The way that you receive the drug, the timing of it, the whether it's injection or a pill, you have to make this decision." And so she stayed up all night reading a subreddit about this condition and making notes about all the things that people said about the various treatments, and then made a very personal decision based on her own life. And that's something that I think artificial intelligence could help with. Again, if you could point it at and say, this is a patient community, this is a conversation among people that I trust, summarize it for me. She wouldn't have had to stay up all night. There could have been tallies, essentially, that she did by hand that AI could do in a second.
There's a couple of things about that. First of all, what you're talking about frightens me because the AI, quote AI, that we have now is so incredibly prone to being wrong and to coming up with nonsense that sounds plausible, which is the worst kind. And so the notion, if a doctor is going to read the summary of the case notes, you want them to check every fact. And that might actually take longer than just reading the case notes in the first place. The second thing is that reading a Reddit thread or any other discussion forum, the information you pick up is not just the information about the treatments, it's information about the people who use the treatments. And I'm not sure that an LLM that an AI summary, a tally, would actually capture the social part of that. And I think it's actually really important because, you read the person's notes on, well, I use this drug, but one of the problems with it is they want you to take it these times, but they assume that you get up early, and I'm actually a night owl. Or, well, in my particular circumstances, a lot of that would get lost in the process of just doing the simple tally. So I'm not sure she wouldn't have, she might have ended up being better served giving up that night of her life.
So I love that. It's something that we are on the cusp of this new possibility. And what I want to do is just keep shining a spotlight on involving patients and remembering that patients and survivors and caregivers have so much knowledge that is currently being ignored by the mainstream healthcare system. How do we make sure that we don't continue the inequity, continue leaving out the lived experience, as we go into the age of AI in medicine?
It just kind of reminds me of some of the discussions we've been having about kind of where we are with the internet. Jeff Jarvis has triggered this quite a bit recently when he's talking about how, it took centuries for print to really manifest as, all the effects that it was going to have. And the internet's just been around for, 3 decades or so, as mainstream. So we're probably really early on, and we're in this transitional phase, and things look like they're just completely going to hell. It just looks like the internet is creating a real kind of shitstorm here. But it really is that we're at a stage where we have a lot of, like, we're stumbling into a lot of the downsides, and we haven't figured out how to address those yet. And I kind of think that's true here too. And we're fairly new to a new paradigm of thinking about how healthcare works, how the patient is included. And there's a lot of stuff to work out. We kind of don't know yet, right?
That's exactly right. And just to circle back to the beginning, I think so often about what Tom Ferguson would say, and sometimes I would have lunch with him, and there would have been some insult or some setback. You know, somebody wouldn't understand what we were trying to create with our research. And it was Tom who said, "We just need to keep shining a light on the path. Everyone comes to it eventually." He was so optimistic and really believed that if we continue to talk about the power of patients connecting with each other at the very basic level, this idea that no matter what the technology looks like, that connection, that idea that you are not alone in your suffering. There are people who would love to help you if only they knew how to find you. That's at the basis of the patient-led revolution. And that's what Tom's gift was. And it's my honor to keep bringing that forward.
Yeah, well, that's fantastic. And that kind of makes me think about long COVID. So long COVID is something that probably would have festered a lot longer than it has before it started bubbling up into the visible range, before the kind of patient empowerment movement started having some force. But people are listening a little bit more readily now. And I think that we're actually at a point where long COVID is acknowledged as a thing that is really a condition that people really have. That might have taken years before, right?
Absolutely. And they borrowed the playbooks from the disability rights movement. They borrowed the playbook from ACT UP, which is why I think Anthony Fauci was probably more open to the idea of the long COVID patients being able to contribute to the science because he had the experience with HIV/AIDS that we talked about earlier. So it's because there was a widespread need for data. The entire world was struggling through darkness, and the patients were able to flick a match and say, "We have some data about this emerging phenomenon," and people paid attention.
You know, I think all of this is a really good idea and all of that, but when you live outside the United States, the US healthcare system, such as it is so fundamentally broken because of the business interests. There are whole counties across the country where there is no maternity ward. That seems like such a basic thing not to have, you know? And I read that people have to drive longer and longer distances to find an emergency room or to get any kind of medical care. And so on the one hand, you have this great idea, but no amount of patient-led revolution can fix the fact that if you get into trouble in childbirth, you have not got professional help. And the disparity there is just so enormous.
I couldn't agree more. My research has always focused on individuals and communities and what they can do to change their fate and to create the inventions and innovations that they need. But I agree that there is another conversation to be had and many more books to be written about the broken nature of the American healthcare systems. And I would say that my one edit is that there's no one system, it's multiple systems, and they're all broken. But yes, I'm for better or for worse, not a political scientist or an economist. And so my focus is on the research that I've done with patients, survivors, and caregivers.
Well, we've reached the end of our hour, and I guess that's a good time to stop. It's kind of a cliffhanger. Maybe you'll come back sometime and we can talk some more about this. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great conversation, and everybody should get out and buy a copy of Rebel Health. It's It's a manual for the future.
Thank you, Susanna.
Thank you.
See you soon.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.